Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey listeners, Becky here with a quick content warning before we start. The first half of today's episode deals with some subject matter that may be disturbing to some listeners, including being taken advantage of while vulnerable, discussions around sexual assault and consent, the use of the R word in a clip, as well as a story about a film that involves one of the former heads of Miramax. If that's not something you're up for today, we totally understand. Feel free to join us for the second half of the episode, where the subject is lighter. You can skip to the 41-minute, 1-second mark to hear that. Thank you so much for listening. And now, on with the show. A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton. And once again, I'm joined by Cam Maitland and Alicia Fletcher. And this is the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. Femme fatale. Vamp. Man-eater. Lady jerk. They're dangerous, unpredictable women, cunning, seductive, promiscuous, using their feminine wiles to destroy men and the lives of others. In stories, men are helpless until it's almost too late to save themselves and their family. But don't worry, the femme fatale will inevitably destroy herself. She obviously has to be punished. The late 80s and early 90s were full of these minxes. Think of Alex the Bunny Boiler in Fatal Attraction sinking into the bathtub riddled with bullet holes. Hetty in Single White Female stabbed in the back. Heck, even Catwoman bites it, or rather kisses it, at the end of Batman Returns. 1992 saw two femme fatales, or rather one 17-year-old girl and a schoolteacher, in real life get absolutely crucified by the media, one of them which would go on to change the way we talk about trials forever. Cam, who are we talking about today?
Yeah, well, as we talk about in the show, I think what made these evil kind of women killers or manipulative women in film pop off is really Amy Fisher, the Long Island Lolita, she's unfortunately known. But essentially, it was this case where she shot her much older lover's wife. Even at the time, is kind of a question of, was it manipulation? How much was she involved? And then the other person we're talking about is the prior trial of Pamela Smart. A lot is kind of lost to time a bit, but really predated the O.J. Simpson trial as a media circus.
It was the first televised trial, wasn't it?
So it's the first trial. There were televised trials before, like Ted Bundy, but it's the first trial where the cameras were allowed in for the whole trial.
Okay.
And the first trial where that synced up with the 24-hour news cycle, essentially. So the serial killers, some of the people, the previous trials, just it was the nightly news. But with Pamela Smart, you had places that were just showing Pamela Smart constantly. Like, if you think of the O.J. Simpson trial for anyone our age, it was the equivalent of that.
Can you talk a little bit about who Pamela Smart was? That's a name that I'm sure maybe some people aren't familiar with.
Yeah, it's another murder where she's also very young. I believe she's 22. And she had a teenage lover who was 15, but she also was married. What they argue is she got her lover and three of his friends to murder her husband.
Is this the woman that To Die For is kind of based on?
Yeah. Yes, yes. So stuff like To Die For is based on stuff like Serial
Loosely.
Mom, which we talk about. Serial Mom is very inspired by Pamela Smart. And she is not necessarily the person that those portray where she was obsessed with the media coverage. I don't think she likes it. She is still in jail with no chance of parole. Mm. Very interesting thing. I really recommend, if you're interested in more Pamela Smart, there's an HBO documentary called Captivated: The Trials of Pamela Smart, which a lot is really about, hey, why does everyone forget that this happened before OJ, and kind of set the scene for these trial by media. And Pamela Smart essentially says her argument, especially against no chance of parole because she's been in jail for a long time, is that her trial was unfairly influenced by the media. Mm. And you see a lot of the ways that the O.J. Simpson trial, especially if you watch the People versus O.J. Simpson, you see how much more locked down those jurors were. Like, those jurors got like a tape of Seinfeld a night they were allowed to watch. They were not allowed TV. They were not allowed to talk to anybody. And it's partially because I think any lawyer says that the Pamela Smart case was quite influenced by the media coverage and really turned the public against her. She's seems undoubtedly involved in the crime, and kind of people say like undoubtedly if and she is also in jail for conspiracy to commit murder. She did not commit the murder, and it really kind of got people talking. And I think on top of that, those two big cases, the films we're going to talk about, also are very influenced by changes in rape law. Like for instance, in 1992 we have our rape shield law in Canada, which precludes the ability to cross-examine people based on their sexual history or their profession. So a sex worker is not immune to rape because they are a sex worker. And also in the United States, it was the beginning of changes to laws. So for instance, in 1993, marital rape was no longer allowed. Your husband could rape you.
It took that long.
So this is when a lot of those things were changing, which I think plays in very closely, as well as, for instance, we talked about already the Clarence Thomas hearings, sexual harassment, consent, things like that. And that really, as you said, led to these huge movies, Batman Returns, Basic Instinct, and The Hand That Rocks the Cradle were all in the top 10 films of 1992.
Well, and scared the crap out of the populace. I guess that leads...
Especially the male populace.
Yeah, totally. Well, I guess that... Well, and women, too. And that actually leads us into our first film, because I don't know about you guys. Did you have older siblings or cousins who exposed you to movies you were, like, way too young to see, let alone process?
Yeah.
No, Becky, I had two very ill-advised parents who rented the Hand That Rocks the Cradle and had an 8-year-old girl watch it.
Yeah, I was thinking about this because, like you mentioned, Candyman earlier. I saw Candyman at the same time as this, and Silence of the Lambs. I was 9.
Me too.
And they messed me up pretty hard. But honestly, the one with the imagery that messed me up the most was Hand That Rocks the Cradle. And I mean, I could still, before I rewatched this movie as an adult for this podcast, I still remembered, I think it was a fire poker or a crowbar. I don't remember what Ernie Hudson gets beaten with.
Poker.
Yeah, because I was looking between my fingers the second time. The gynecology scene and the impalement at the end, spoiler alert, are the three things that like really still stood out for me. I'm now able to process what's going on, and I'm still horrified, especially by that gynecology scene. And I think one of the reasons why is because it was written by a woman who knows exactly how vulnerable you are when you're in a gynecologist's office.
Yeah, let's talk about Amanda Silver. So first of all, this is The Hand That Rocks the Cradle is directed by Curtis Hanson, and this is not the first time we've had a Curtis Hanson film.
And it won't be the last time.
Podcast.
Yeah, he's quite prolific.
Yeah, he comes up a lot. I think he's an excellent director. But Amanda Silver, this is her kind of debut screenplay. If you Google her now, she's a very, very powerful woman. She writes, along with her partner, Rick Jaffa, the recent Rise in the Planet of the Apes franchise. She's currently working on Avatar 2, 3, 4, 5 through 9, or however many James Cameron Avatar films he's working on. She's a powerhouse. But she got her start writing The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. What you're describing, Becky, with that visual memory from your childhood of those particular scenes and how you're able to process it now, I have those same memories of the exact three scenes you're talking about and even more. As an adult, I still cannot process what is like so terrifying of this film. I mean, obviously, the three of us decided we were going to do a podcast on this title. And I knew when writing it down that I would deplore the idea of having to watch this again. Let's see, I was 8. So like almost 30 years later, this is one of the most terrifying films I've ever seen. It is a very simple story. It's about there's a woman who's pregnant with her second child. She has a new obstetrician because her old one's retired. While on the table, he sexually assaults her. And she tells her husband, who thank God believes her right away, because there's a lot of films like this about like, oh, there's someone's crazy and they're trying to kill me. And the husbands never believe the wives. And actually, this film is different for that reason. She comes forward and reports him. Turns out he's done this to a variety of women. He's going to be put on trial. Instead of standing trial, he cowardly shoots himself. At the time of his death, his wife, played by Rebecca De Mornay, is pregnant. The stress of this, she loses her baby, has to have an emergency hysterectomy. And then, of course, because of the lawsuit that emerges because of this, all of his former assets are frozen, so she loses her $8 million Seattle house. She's super pissed. She's had a hard go of it. And so perhaps you would have empathy for her sympathy in the beginning of the film, but boy, do they destroy that quickly.
Yeah, don't they ever.
Listen, if you want a good quote, Rita Kempley of the Washington Post described Rebecca De Mornay as the most unsympathetic villainess since The Alien, mm-hmm. which is pretty good.
I would compare her to the Terminator in Terminator 1.
Sure.
Okay. Like, unstoppable.
I actually think it's Jaws. For me, it's the shark in Jaws, like a blue-eyed Jaws. Ugh, she's so freaky.
That is, yeah, I could see. I mean, I hope listeners are... The fact that listeners need to take away is she's a bad person.
You also never get to see her before, either, really. It's just she's thrown into the situation and just goes on the attack.
The only time you see her is when her husband's colleagues or the board of the medical board tells her, like, all of his assets are frozen. But she's, like, 8 months pregnant, wearing the tightest power suit I've ever seen in my life. So that gives you a sense of who she is. But she decides to pose as a nanny under a different name, a nanny to the family of the woman who first reported this case. So she blames her. This woman's played by Annabella Sciorra, who's quite good in it. And she has a 5-year-old daughter and you know, has had her pregnancy reach term. So she's a newborn infant. And so Rebecca De Mornay's character, whose name is Peyton Flanders, which is a very puzzling name, poses as this woman who's lost her baby and her husband recently. And she just, you know, she just wants to, like, experience family, like, through being a nanny. And then she systematically gaslights the entire family into various scenarios where Annabella Sciorra's character is undermined. So she starts breastfeeding the baby so that Annabella Sciorra's baby is turned off her own milk. There is, and we're going to talk about this character quite a bit more, but I'll just bring it up. Ernie Hudson plays the kind of the groundskeeper who is labeled in 1992 terms as a special person. And he is framed as a molester by Peyton. So they fire him and he's like the only protector for the family. And then, of course, is going to totally try to sleep with the husband of the family, the father. It's terrifying. To give an example, so Annabella Sciorra's character suffers from asthma, which I think is a very relatable. I mean, asthma affects a huge portion of the population, and we know how terrifying it is either to have or if you've been around someone.
It triggers her, too, when she gets stressed out, and she is constantly stressed out.
Well, yeah. So Rebecca De Mornay's character goes around the house and empties every single puffer that she has so that when she has an asthma attack, she hopes that she'll kill her.
But it's like, also
a great scene.
Yeah, so deliberately, as she's just sitting there, like, just pumping it with those big, which is why I say shark, because, like, her blue eyes are so freaking vacant the whole time, and you're just like, oh.
She's incredible in this. I don't even understand how she didn't destroy her career by playing a character this evil. There's another very well-known actress making a pretty early role, and that would be Julianne Moore is in this film, very young, as Annabella Sciorra's character's best friend, who is killed in a glass greenhouse incident orchestrated by Peyton. It is almost like the moment that puts this film from thriller to, like, slasher horror.
To bring this as well to another film by Curtis Hanson, or written by Curtis Hanson, it's similar to The Silent Partner, where it's this cat and mouse game, and then it flips into a slasher where you watch a woman get decapitated by a fish tank. It's very similar. Yeah.
I think he's making disguised slashers, you might be right. Mm. And you're right, Becky, to point out really early in the film, just her in stirrups on the table being sexually assaulted by the man who plays Q in Star Trek The Next Generation, which I have to say, as an 8-year-old, I loved Q, and that's what really messed me up, because I didn't understand what sexual assault was. Sure. There was so much that while I was watching this at 37 years old, I just thought about me watching this with my parents, and I was like, what? I'm not trying to bash my parents. I can do that enough in my private life. What were they thinking? It is incredible. And you're right. It's because it's written by a woman. Rebecca De Mornay is phenomenal in this. And I don't think she had ever been properly really utilized prior to
after.
Oh, she's got some good stuff, I would say. I was actually shocked because I was kind of like, did this ruin her career?
Yeah.
But she's worked constantly. And she's got some interesting roles. And I do want to say a good fact that you guys may or may not know is she took this role after her big thing she wanted in 1992.
You're stealing my fact.
Oh, well.
That's, Cam can have
one. She wanted to be Tinkerbell and Hood.
She wanted to be Tinkerbell.
You've been talking this whole time, Elisa. Let me have one fact. So she wanted to be Tinkerbell and Hook, and when she didn't get it, she was like, ah, screw it. Hand of the Rock's the Cradle.
Yeah. And then Julia Roberts got cast as Tinkerbell, and everyone on set called her Tinker Hell because she was so terrible to work with. That is true. And I don't know. There's a husband in this film. I don't remember the actor's name. He's completely useless. This is really the battle of two matriarchs, and it gets grim. Ernie Hudson's character, Cam. Okay, Cam.
Me?
Ernie, Cam and Becky. What do we think about Ernie Hudson's character? Because I am very conflicted.
Okay, before we get into this, allow me just to play a quick clip of Ernie Hudson talking about why he wanted the role, because he campaigned for it. And that's actually, I think, an important thing to think about.
You know, when I first read the script and I wasn't up for the part and I really sort of campaigned for it, I went in and I tried to get them to see me in the role because it was not written for a black actor. I think the studio might have felt that if it wasn't done right, either it could be very embarrassing to people who are mentally disabled, or you can make some very negative statements about black men in general. So you had to play the guy, I felt, as a person. And I visited a lot of the homes for the mentally disabled. And I found that there are a lot of people, thousands, who do have problems that we somehow don't see because we have a way of sort of, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And I tried to find that common denominator that they all have, no matter what level of disability. When I went to the first dance, they all came over to me and they shook my hand and were so happy to see me and they hugged me. And I thought it was because I was in Ghostbusters. And then I noticed they did it to everybody. Mm. It had nothing to do with it. They have this enormous capacity
to give love
and to want to be a part of. And that's what the movie, in a lot of ways, is about.
I'm on the fence. I think the biggest issue, pardon the pun, I think the biggest issue I have is that they're very inconsistent with what it is that's, what his particular handicap is, like what exactly his disability is, if you will. Sorry. And so, like, sometimes he's very intelligent, very quick, and sometimes he's super slow.
Yeah.
So it's I think the inconsistencies are my biggest issue.
I mean,
he
seems like he's probably on the autism spectrum more than anything. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing that I think Hollywood still hasn't grappled with yet, where it's like you would like this role to be cast with somebody who is actually has these issues, but that's still, I think nowadays we push for it a lot more, but it still rarely happens. And I think he gives a great performance, and he's really the audience surrogate because he's one of the only people that gets what's going on throughout almost the entire movie.
There's a TV show that would have been airing at the time that this film, and this film was number one at the box office for 4 weeks, which is quite impressive. And that's Life Goes On, which was the first show that had I think the first episode's in 1989. It goes to 1993. The first time you had an actor with Down syndrome portraying someone with Down syndrome happens in this period. So it was something that was very discussed in the media, which I do think would have tempered a bit of how, and I'm not saying Ernie Hudson's character has Down syndrome, although that is, the R word is brought up a lot in a very hateful way by the bitch that is Rebecca De Mornay. This would have been a discussion point for sure in media.
Oh, there was. This is actually from the same interview with Ernie Hudson, and you're going to hear Regis and Kathy Lee, who are interviewing them. And I think this is kind of an indication of where that conversation in media was at the time.
Character was very different in a lot of ways from what I am and how I see myself. So it was a good acting.
Is he mentally retarded, this gentleman?
Not retarded. They make that a point, right?
Though? Yeah.
Mentally disadvantaged?
He's mentally disabled. Retarded is not really a good word. Because there's so many levels of retardation.
Of course. Sure.
Yeah.
The other thing that I'm kind of fascinated with is how many critics who watch this don't talk about the Ernie Hudson performance. They mostly focus on 100%. And because it's also very uncomfortable in that, like, we're not going to believe this person and how everybody in this is so vulnerable. It is a film perfectly calculated for maximum ick.
Yeah. And that's the one thing where I almost think that if you cast somebody actually on an autism spectrum, it would push the film into feeling too gross.
Like, too exploitive.
I think if Rebecca De Mornay was that mean to somebody that you couldn't go, okay, well, he's acting.
It's okay, he's in Ghostbusters. We know
he's exactly.
Not.
It's Ernie Hudson. We love him. Like, he does get, he gets his revenge, if you will. I think that would push it almost to, that's the only thing that I think is like, you almost couldn't. It's a very strange movie. I mean, there's a ongoing scene throughout it of Gilbert and Sullivan music.
Oh, you mean the HMS Pinafore and yes. Pirates of Penzance?
yeah. So that's weird because there's so many of their operettas have switching babies in them. It's produced by a subsidiary of Disney, which is very odd. Hollywood Pictures, which was essentially made on the back of The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. It's one of their only major financial successes other than The Sixth Sense.
There was a talk about remaking this at ABC Family back in 2013. Yeah. I think someone went, "What the hell are we doing?"
Why would
and
you
did
do
not
that?
Do it
it's
for ABC
still
Family.
Owned by Disney. It's kind of an unusual one.
Speaking of remakes, I was really fascinated and I'm very curious. I don't know how to access them, but it was remade in Hindi in 1993 and then remade again in 2009 in Telugu. So like two different dialects in India have used this film in sort of a Bollywood way. And I would love to see an Indian interpretation of this story. Like, I'm fascinated.
It's just preying on such universal ick factors, if you will. And what's interesting to me is when you watch, like, say, Siskel and Ebert talk about this, or really any man reviewing this film, the thing that they all find it very upsetting, but the thing they cannot wrap their head around is why she hired this woman in the first place.
With no background check.
And it's funny because Ebert loved this movie and actually went against Siskel trying to defend the premise.
I found this film worked, and that's usually the way I approach it. I go to a thriller expecting to be thrilled. I don't go expecting to have all of my sensibilities respected and all of my sensitivities honored, because I know that in a movie like this, I can almost anticipate exactly what it's going to be
about. Can I ask you one question? Yeah. Would the picture have been better if you had bought the premise? See, that's the where we do have this argument. You'll say, but Gene, you got to grant a movie its premise. And I say, not really. Let him write a better premise, then I'll grant it.
I grant the premise. You could pick up the paper and read about killer nannies right now, going on all over the country.
Oh, Roger.
That's true.
It's so effective. It really is an elevated, cheap exploitation film. Coming back to exactly how you introduced this film, Becky, I think is credited to not just Curtis Hanson's very deft direction, but it's Amanda Silver. It's just the vulnerability. Like and I'm happy that this affects all genders this in a similar way, because you would think it would just be kind of geared towards women, because how many men have had that experience of being in stirrups and not having met your doctor before, and like that kind of intimacy is so terrifying.
And if I can just for a second, I'm going to skip forward 10 seconds if you don't want a graphic depiction of this, but when the glove comes off during that exam, that was based on a joke Curtis Hanson's wife's gynecologist made when he went with her to her appointment.
Oh my God. I don't know. It's I really want to recommend this film to people with a few reservations that it is this graphic. Please do not show your 8-year-old daughter this film.
No,
that would
no.
be the other reservation. If I could go have a time machine and talk to my parents about what kind of media they showed me. I'm going to backtrack and defend my parents. There was a possibility that I watched this, crept down in my basement steps, looking out into the living room, because that's how I watched films I wasn't allowed to watch, I think they knew I was there. I would like be on the lower floor watching through a banister. That's how I saw a lot of movies. But
this on cable too. In spite of it being an R-rated movie, it was a real cable favorite.
Yeah, so, you could have just wandered on it as a kid.
Yeah, I think it was just a Fox afternoon sort of movie.
But those are the films that are scariest, right? Like there's not a lot of blood in this. There is a little bit of violence. It's not that graphic. It's the psychological graphicness that will always scare you more than a Michael Myers film.
I do want to bring in just quickly one of the original people who was still considered for the role of Mrs. Mott, who's played by Rebecca De Mornay, was Sybil Shepherd, and she turned down the role because she found it anti-feminist. She believed that it was actually a cautionary tale about women who are punished because they can't handle their own children.
I don't think she's wrong.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And she had two young children at the time as well. She's later on in the interview, she actually says, "I should have taken the damn thing. It would have been great for my career." Yeah. But she's not wrong.
I also think it's very interesting that like this woman is targeted because essentially she spoke up for sexual harassment.
Yeah.
First.
It goes out of their way to say that she wasn't involved in the case trying to get money or anything. She just wanted this guy to have his license taken away, essentially.
And as you said earlier, her husband's the one who pushes her into it. So there is that whole concept of like, I can't say anything. No one's going to believe me. Like, it's very early for addressing those kind of ideas.
He says basically like, you know, because she doesn't feel like she can do it. And he's like, if you don't do it, and he does it to other women, which at the time, the viewer doesn't know that there's multiple women who will come forward, several women, in fact, you know, if you don't come out and it happens to other women, like, you're kind of at fault, which is a very, that's a difficult line to toe. That's that was also very relatable. Like, just listening to that was like, God, these are the conversations we're still having.
I think that leads us perfectly into our next film. So, do you guys feel the need to know why a character is the way they are? Do you need a backstory for Hannibal Lecter? How about the Grinch or Willy Wonka? How many movies have ruined stories by, among other things, adding backstories or flashbacks that don't really need to be there, that were never intended to be there? And that's only part of the story behind Love Crimes, a movie that's hard to track down, and we all don't necessarily recommend that you watch it, but the story behind it is really something else, and the filmmaker's other work definitely deserves rediscovery. The clips from this segment are going to come from an interview with filmmaker Lizzie Borden, conducted by friends of the show, Will Sloan and Justin DeClue, who appear in the A Year in Film TV series, on their excellent podcast, The Important Cinema Club. Justin and Will are great. Go check it out. A word of warning for this one, as if you're still here from the last one, Miramax was the distributor for this picture, so a convicted human monster is part of the story. Oh boy, Cam, let's talk about Love Crimes and Lizzie Borden and the terrible things that happened.
Yeah, but beyond Weinstein, it's also a tough sit. If you do manage to dig up a version of this film, it is also about, I mean, we were talking about the kind of institutional sexual harassment of The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. This one is about, essentially, Sean Young plays a district attorney who has become obsessed with this guy who poses as a photographer of models, and then has what is legally consensual but rough sex with the people he tricks into modeling
and coerced sex.
And he's lied. They find out later he's lied. He sometimes robs them lightly, and he just has icky gross sex with a lot of women. He's a serial rapist, essentially, but in a legal way that is a real loophole. So she sets out to catch him. She kind of finds out where he is and tries to entrap him, essentially, but then gets caught up in an odd psychosexual, what was, I believe, intended to be sadomasochistic relationship, but at the time the 90s weren't quite ready for sadomasochism.
We had to wait for Secretary, apparently.
It sounds like it was kind of a weird, like a darker Secretary, kind of something like the Hollywood Reporter goes out of their way to weirdly be like, well, this guy's not even a criminal, he's a macho misogynist. And you're like, oh boy. So this movie, we were interested in talking about it because it is a famous kind of, we were talking about all these women making movies, and this one did kind of famously ruin Lizzie Borden's career for a long time. It was one of the most kind of famous fiascos of the time. It also sort of ruined Sean Young's career, among other things. She's back now, thankfully. It was pitched as an erotic thriller. It is deeply not erotic. No.
Well, you even look at the poster. I'm actually looking at it right now, and there's Sean Young in black lace lingerie splayed out with Patrick Bergen just kind of like hovering over top of her, grabbing her wrist and her calf at the same time. And that is kind of the movie, but not the movie
I believe Harvey Weinstein art directed that particular poster.
And I mean, you knowing, if you're unfamiliar with Lizzie Borden, she's this intense feminist filmmaker that makes these very interesting films dealing with a lot of women's issues that are unusual, coming at them from angles that you wouldn't expect.
Born in Flames is the big one.
How would you describe her films, Alicia? Do you have like a...
You know, I have to say I've only seen this and Born in Flames. Flames. So I don't know if I'm, not that she has that many films, but, you know, we
Working
we did,
Girls is the other big one.
Yeah, we did a screening, Sarah Ty Black did a screening for Black Gold at the Royal here in Toronto of
Born in Flames,
with a Q&A with Lizzie Borden, which was really, really wonderful, like via Skype. It's hard to just, there's nothing like Born in Flames. It's a DIY, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic, punk, feminist, black rights, like it's I can't describe it.
Yeah,
I watched that whole thing.
No, I know. Yeah, it's like she's like a very cutting edge political
avant-garde
feminist art filmmaker, essentially.
Kind of Riot Girl. There's some Riot Girl in there.
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly, when I'm trying to think of what she's trying to do here, another movie that comes to mind is somebody who collaborated with her as an actress on Born in Flames, Kathryn Bigelow's Blue Steel.
Yeah,
which
it's
is
very similar. That
also a weird attraction repulsion female law enforcement male criminal
with very problematic rape politics
exactly.
as well that are actually similar to this
yes and so I think that when I'm trying to figure out what because the whole thing is it's very interesting and why this interview that Justin and Will did is so interesting is because even contemporaneously it was known that Lizzie Borden wasn't happy with the final product that's in theaters
but a director's cut came out Cam
exactly
and then at the very end Harvey was the one who told me that he would destroy my career if I took my name off the film. And even the so-called director's cut, which was basically just 8 minutes of R-rated stuff, that was just a ploy by, you know, Harvey kind of sitting on me and basically saying, well, you know, say it's the director's cut, we'll make it the unrated version just to make up for all the money you lost with your movie.
So the theatrical cut we didn't see. I'm pretty sure we saw the director's cut from based on my research. The theatrical cut sounds like it was borderline nonsense because 8 minutes were cut. They re-added those 8 minutes, which were called like extra erotic scenes, especially for HBO as a sales tactic for HBO. At the time, Lizzie Borden called it a director's cut. She did press saying, this is my real vision, la da da da. What we learn from Justin and Will is there was no director's cut. The film was essentially taken away from her in almost pre-production. She shot it. She did her job, partially because Harvey Weinstein said throughout he would ruin her career if she didn't do it. So even those interviews in the 90s for the director's cut were coerced. She felt that she had to admit that this was a director's cut she was interested in and say that it was her vision when essentially there is no version of this film which is at all her vision. It was taken away from her. Kit Carson wrote these flashbacks that you're talking about.
I think they needed, at a certain point in post-production, they felt they needed to explain her in some way. That was at a point where it was Kit Carson, and I forgot his wife's name, always in a cloud of cigarette smoke coming in, and they basically took over the editing. It was not really me anymore. And so that whole backstory idea was sort of invented after the film was shot. And I think part of it was because they didn't have an ending. And because they didn't have an ending, it had to kind of delve, I think this was their rationale, into what made her do what she did. I think it was a kind of joke for Kit Carson because I think he made the woman look a lot like his ex-wife, Karen Black. Drama going on between Kit and Karen at that time, you know, about their son. So I thought they looked really sleazy and just horrible.
Which is unfortunate. Kit Carson is a writer I enjoy, but it sounds like he was not a very good actor and person in this situation.
The flashbacks are nonsensical.
Now, we should be clear that the Karen Black comparison is not confirmed, is alleged, but the mother character is strikingly similar in resemblance to Karen Black with like the long black curly hair and
I love Karen Black, and that makes me even more angry about this film.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing. I mean, even contemporaneously, Lizzie Borden said that like a lot of her original vision for the film, once it started going, was lost. Because she essentially said it was the difference. Her vision would be an NC-17 film, and they said the movie cost too much for that rating. So it had to be turned R.
Let's start at the very beginning of this story, because mm-hmm. she was approached with a script by Alan Moyle, which was very much a cat and mouse game that mm-hmm. dealt with consent, which she obviously was very interested in dealing with. And then the rights to who the production was going to be done by ended up in different places and finally settled in with Miramax and the Weinsteins, while still having another investor who wanted to make a different type of movie. So then there became two different warring visions of what this film was supposed to be, and the script was entirely torn apart, and they started filming without any sort yeah. of cohesion of what the script was going to be.
You know, when something is taken out of your hands that way by so many different people, you know, by executives from a company who are writing, I mean, I can't tell you how many sheets of paper got put under my door, and I'm comparing them like, oh, do I shoot this company's notes or do I shoot that company's notes? Like, what gets shot? I mean, it's just at a certain point, when is it your film?
No ending. That was definitely the thing she notes, is that they started filming with no ending. She did a rewrite by Lori Frank, which you don't see credited, so I don't even know how much that was used in the final film. It's a strange situation. We know she didn't want Sean Young as the lead. That was very much something that was forced on her. But at the same time, I think actually Sean Young does a fine job. Yeah. I don't see a huge problem there. I can see how that was a frustrating experience.
Well, her initial instinct was Natasha Richardson, which would have really, a fascinating sure. role for her mm-hmm. and would have really elevated the project to something different, right?
Definitely made it more of an art film. Sean Young was much more of a commercial actress at the time.
Well, the amount of stunt casting as well going on in this film. So you have Patrick Bergen, as we mentioned earlier, who is coming off Sleeping with the Enemy, which was a big thing. He's essentially playing the same character. Yeah, totally. Same character as that. And then Arnita Walker plays this black police officer who is also Sean Young's friend, who she puts in these compromising positions that are ethically questionable, yeah. which I thought was a fascinating thing.
She's the best part of the movie.
Easily agreed.
I actually super love her and the other cop who become buddies. The only Jewish cop in Savannah, yeah. Georgia.
It's a great little thing, right?
Yeah, becomes her buddy. Yeah. There are these touches where you're like, oh, I think I see the... And yeah, I think the Lizzie Borden thing absolutely is about this African-American cop who is put in these ethically terrible situations by the DA, which is very
interesting. She's staged as being a prostitute and bust to entrap police officers who are beating up prostitutes.
And put in danger.
Yeah.
You can tell that the whole movie starts with Sean Young pushing that too far.
Yeah.
She puts that officer in danger to try to make sure she has the evidence.
And it's unclear, but there might even be a sexual assault that occurs in that
yes.
scenario.
That character's played by Arnita Walker, but Harvey Weinstein was pushing for Robin Givens at the time mm-hmm. for stunt casting. Robin Givens famously in a very assaultive relationship with Mike Tyson. And that information, the divorce and that information had come out very recently. So to put her in this film about rough sex and consent and all that is really stomach churning.
The nice thing is, of course, that Robin Givens went on to be stunt casted in Boomerang in a very charming
yes.
role where she is the woman in control mm-hmm. who ruins Eddie Murphy's mm-hmm. Romantic life by essentially not caring about him, using him for sex and being like, goodbye.
And then, I think she's his boss, right?
Yeah, they're at least working. They're in a working relationship. So that's great. It's good to know that she got such a better role.
Yeah.
If that happened, I assume she would have turned this down to her credit.
I think the thing that, I mean, there's so many things that enrage me about this situation, but I think the thing that pisses me off the most is that you can see what this could have been and how mm-hmm. forward thinking and how interesting and thoughtful and frightening in the similar way to Hand That Rocks the Cradle is. Like, it could have been as easily a talking point as that film, but it's just desperate. Talking about those concepts of consent, that back and forth, what is the line, what legally is okay, morally isn't, you know, when can you turn people in? Like, that's just fascinating, especially for this time.
And I think for a psychological thriller, and it's something that rarely actually gets dealt with in film, and then like a psychosexual thriller, that there is this attraction and repulsion to rough sex with women, you know, like this sadomasochistic, and it's something that's so horrible that every woman is constantly in fear of, obviously, because we live in a rape culture. But it is something, there is obviously this attraction to it. And but man, that's a needle to very carefully thread. Yeah. Probably not with Harvey Weinstein involved.
God.
And probably not with rewrites by a man.
Hey.
Boy.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I'd be very curious to see the original Alan Moyle script of this and what that actually looks like. Alan Moyle, for people who don't know, famous for Empire Records.
I just want to point out one scene just to kind of capitalize on what could have gone wrong with this film. She looks at her like very important casework, which are all paper based because it's 1982, while in the bathtub.
Yeah.
And that really bothers me. Like, there was a lot of things that bothered me about this film. There's a very disturbing This Little Piggy scene with Patrick Bergen where he's like
the
playing with her toes.
That is no good for me. The horse scene, no good.
No good. But
yeah, I've never seen Sleeping with the Enemy.
It's terrifying.
If you talk about wondering how Rebecca De Mornay bounced back, how the hell did this guy bounce back?
Did he bounce back?
I don't know.
I mean,
he's in Patriot Games the same year, at least. He's in a very good Robin Hood that I know people love from 1991. The alternative to Prince of Thieves. There's another one. We'll probably do that if we ever have a 1991
episode.
It's
the Christopher Columbus of 1991. Yeah.
That's coming up.
But yeah, what a creepy, creepy role. I think
it's the mustache. It's a creepy mustache, which is the same mustache that he has in Sleeping with the Enemy.
He continued to have a great career, but I think it's partially because nobody saw this movie because, man, oh, man, if this movie was popular, I would not be able to get some of these scenes out of my head.
The one thing I do have to say about this that is I think the beauty of the internet and the beauty of podcasting is that now these artists and these filmmakers who had learned very valuable lessons are able to impart their lessons of what they learned and when they should have walked away to a younger generation of filmmakers who should recognize their rights.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an interesting story because I think Lizzie Borden tried to be as canny as possible to do everything to please everyone because she was concerned about her career being ruined. And the truth is she did everything Weinstein said and her career was ruined because of, like, he didn't ruin her career. This movie scuttled stuff for a long time. And it just made people think she was a bad director. So,
and she unsuccessfully, she tried very hard to take her name off it, even after.
Yes.
And
he said he would ruin her. It was not doing what he said, because she did a lot of what he said.
Yeah.
It was that she didn't want her name on it. And he said, if you take your name off, I'll ruin you. And leaving her name on hurt her career a lot. So it's these people are terrible and they hurt you no matter what you do.
Oh, man. Well, once again, go check out this interview. It's much more comprehensive. It's fantastic. That's the Important Cinema Club run by Justin DeClue and Will Sloan. It's absolutely fantastic. And go check out Lizzie Borden's early work, because that's obviously more representative of what she's capable of and hopefully what we'll be seeing more of soon. Sounds like she's got some projects that are coming up that are finally getting financed. So we're going to come back and we're going to end 1992 on an up because we're going to talk obviously about dueling Christopher Columbus movies in 1992. There's actually a third one that I'm going to bring up because this thing is wild. Mm. That's coming up after the break.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, listeners, if you're enjoying the podcast, season 2 of the TV show is coming out December 6th.
and you'll be able to see episodes covering 1975, 1986, 1994, and 2000. Not only will you see the faces of Cam, Alicia, and myself, and they're good faces, very expressive, but you're also going to hear from so many more film experts, and maybe even some filmmakers talking about the movies you love. And here's where it gets even better. Hollywood Suite is in free preview for the whole month of December, and you can watch both seasons of A Year in Film and great movies from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Don't forget to watch the first season of A Year in Film now and find out how to catch the free preview while it lasts at hollywoodsuite.ca. You know that Hollywood Suite airs great content, and they've got a real treat lined up. December 19th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the 2000s channel is the premiere of Valley of Tears, a 10-part HBO Max original drama series. You'll be able to watch the first two episodes back-to-back, and then each subsequent episode will air weekly after that on Saturdays. Have raucous Saturday night plans? Don't worry. After the episodes air, they're going to be available on Hollywood Suite On Demand exclusively. Listeners, the trailer alone for Valley of Tears is gorgeous, which makes sense because it's Israel's highest budget TV series ever, and clearly every dollar is on that screen. It follows four soldiers caught in the crossfire of the 1973 Yom Kippur War. I'm excited to watch it, one, because I know nothing about the Yom Kippur War and would like to know more about it, and two, because when people ask me what I'm watching, I'm going to be like, oh, just this amazing HBO Max original 10-part series called Valley of Tears that's airing exclusively on Hollywood Suite in Canada. And then a conversation will be started. Check out hollywoodsuite.ca for more information and to see that awesome trailer. Can you imagine walking into one movie theater expecting to see a thrilling, gritty Ridley Scott take on Christopher Columbus as portrayed by a deeply moist Gerard Depardieu, and what you end up sitting through is a swashbuckling, very dated interpretation of the same story featuring an unkempt furry Tom Selleck as the King of Spain? The general format of this show is that we provide historical context for a segment of our given year, and then we choose two movies that represent that. For this part of the episode, we're just going to be doing things a little differently. We'll be talking about both movies at the same time, because as we said before, 1992 saw two movies that told the story of Christopher Columbus released to the public at the exact same time, and they both failed miserably. Okay, who wants to start? Because this is wild.
Sure, I'll start. Before we get too deep into the movies, I'll just want to talk about the Columbus quincentenary, which is why everything was so exciting. Of course, we all know in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So in 1992, that is 500 years later, we don't celebrate a lot of quincentenaries in the Western Hemisphere, obviously, which we probably should because Indigenous people have been here the whole time, as we will talk about. But yeah, it was a huge deal, especially for Spain. So Spain had in 1992 the World's Fair in Seville. In Barcelona, they had the Olympics. And in around the world, they rebuilt the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, two exact specifications of Columbus to sail especially to America and go up and down the coasts of America because they wanted to underline what someone described as the most significant historical event since the birth of Christ. Yeah, which I mean, you can kind of get, yeah. But it also implies that you have to agree that Christ is 100% a real dude.
Well, these movies do deal with religion a lot.
Yes, so. A lot of religion. God. So just know that this was a huge deal around the world. And interestingly, on top of all of this, obviously, a lot of indigenous groups go, point of order, Columbus, not a great guy. Mm. And interestingly, this was not disorganized. In 1990, 350 representatives from indigenous groups across the Western Hemisphere met in Quito, Ecuador, for what is called the Intercontinental Gathering of Indigenous People of the Americas. And it was the it was one of the largest gatherings of all of the tribes of indigenous people of America. And it was created to specifically combat the quincentennial of Columbus. and provide resistance. And it was especially because at the time, the Columbus Day was celebrated pretty significantly across the hemisphere. It's not so much in Canada, which is interesting, I guess because we have Giovanni Caboto.
Yeah.
So we have a different guy found, quote unquote, found Canada. And also, I think by the time all of us were growing up, even that was thrown out a bit because of the Vikings.
If you're watching the show Secret of Oak Island, like my partner is religiously, you'll know that the history book is currently being rewritten.
Yeah. And I also think we were very into the people's history by the 90s, which involved indigenous people. So just know that also in 1992, there was a massive, it was the big start of dismantling Columbus Day. It was the first city to change. Davis, California was the first city to change Columbus Day to International Solidarity Day with Indigenous people. Mexico City had a massive protest of Indigenous people. Like, this was, honestly, Indigenous people mobilized so hard in America that it properly put a damper on, like, maybe question Columbus and the discovery of America. And it's really what kicked off, especially the modern talk about removing Columbus Day entirely. But a part of this was, of course, that Hollywood wanted to get in on the action, and Spain wanted to get in on the action, because both of these films, one is the official film of the quincentennial, not the one you may think, and the other one is heavily, actually the other one had crazy access, like it's like as if it's shot in the Spanish equivalents of Buckingham Palace, and like
there's like shots of the Alhambra, which is super rare in Granada.
So we should say the two films are Christopher Columbus, The Discovery, and 1492, Conquest of
the
Paradise.
The latter being directed by Ridley Scott.
Yes.
Yeah. But Ridley Scott was originally attached to the first
one. Yes, yes. Everybody wanted Ridley Scott, interestingly.
I like Ridley Scott, but I don't understand.
Yeah. It's interesting because this is really, other than The Duelist, his first film, this is one of his first historical epics.
Yeah.
I think he's a guy who famously, number one, they wanted him because he was coming off of Thelma and Louise, I guess.
Well, that's why I'm asking, though. You come off Thelma and Louise and automatically you're going to be.
I guess he's, also it's interesting because you're like, this movie's kind of Oscar baity. Ridley Scott has been nominated only three times for Oscars, shockingly.
Really?
And he's never won. For directing, he's never won an Oscar. So, I mean, his films have been Best Picture plenty, but it's kind of an interesting thing. So yeah, I think he's famously obsessed with ships. If he watches movies, he enjoys ships. He probably had no bones about shooting on these ships.
Ships and unicorns.
Weirdly, you don't spend as much time on this ship in this movie as you do in the other one. You spend like 90% of the two and a half hour runtime on the damn ship.
Both of these movies are over 2 hours and close to 2.5 hours.
I do want to note, and it's a formality, but I want to apologize because there was a point while watching, I think, The Discovery where I was like, this is one of the worst things to happen. And then I realized we did it to ourselves. Like, you know, like we chose this. Like, this was a really...
I will say I enjoyed myself, especially because I think most of us watched...
You're a masochist, so that makes sense.
Number one, I actually don't... I think I went in thinking that 1492, Conquest of Paradise, was a miserable failure. And I didn't mind it that much because it's just a bloated historical epic, which was common. I mean, we're talking about it's the like coming after Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Last of the Mohicans was in 1918. So it was like a Dances with Wolves, of course, is probably also. Listen, I will also say that as somebody who has drank the Kool-Aid, that Columbus is just terrible. And I was expecting these movies to be a lot kinder to Columbus. Both movies show a fairly mixed portrayal of Columbus, which is interesting.
Okay. I have to point of order because I'm going to say the Discovery is this bizarre swashbuckling epic.
Erotic, kind of Harlequin romance.
If you want Columbus to honk Catherine Zeta-Jones' boobs,
Catherine Zeta-Jones stares out into the middle distance like it's like a 50s melodrama. It's very strange. But it opens with him like straight up sword fighting. I think they're in, they're in the Indies somewhere. Yeah. I'm not sure. But
or
like,
Granada, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe it's Granada. But yeah, they are like, it is never clear. No. This movie is clear about nothing. Yeah. It's like a full like Errol Flynn style sword fight thing that happens with like slapstick and people falling into crowds. Like, it is the weirdest thing. And it feels like a movie made in the 70s.
You almost expect like sound effects like a boing. Like, it's like a cartoon.
I mean, it's worth saying, you're absolutely right. The crazy thing about this is the Discovery feels deeply like an old movie, and 1492 feels like a movie you would make in the 90s, maybe even progressive. Mm-hmm. But yeah. But it's worth saying, so Christopher Columbus, The Discovery, directed by John Glenn, kind of push him out of the way. He doesn't really matter. It's really the brainchild of Ilya and Alexander Sulkin, who most people know from Superman, mm-hmm. but I think it's closest to their other big franchise, which has mostly been lost to time, which is the Three Musketeers.
Right.
They had a series of Three Musketeers movies through the 70s and weirdly tried to reboot it in the 80s with the same Musketeers, Michael York, etc. And so this is very close to that, weirdly, because I think even Superman, probably thanks to Richard Donner, even more than Richard Lester, who took over in 2, was visually all right because of those directors' visions, because the Musketeers, they're directed by Richard Lester as well. They look a lot like the Discovery. So they were trying to cash in. It was that one is especially, I think, fine to say, a shit show.
Well, my personal favorite is Marlon Brando is in this film, which is wild.
As the Grand Inquisitor.
Yeah.
And supposedly the only reason why he took the role was because he claimed, he was told that it was going to be very sympathetic towards Indigenous people's plights. Marlon Brando, of course, very much known for his empathy towards that, even bringing someone to accept his Oscar to discuss
Littlefoot. Oh, sorry. We said that. Yeah. No,
thanks, guys.
I like that name a lot.
But yeah, so this was a big deal for him. And then he appeared in the movie and was like, well, I guess this is just a paycheck, which I wonder if that's what made him more aggressive later on in his life.
I think he doesn't phone it in, especially compared to the other Sulkin famous thing. He's in Superman for 2 minutes, was the highest paid actor of all time, and does phone it in. Tried to get himself replaced with a glowing donut, famously, which he's like, wouldn't it be more interesting if I was this kind of alien? But also, beyond the fact that he took this thinking that it would have a positive portrayal of the effects of Columbus on the Indigenous people, which it has some of.
It's
not great. It's not as good as 1492, but he also sued the production because they tried to not pay the Indigenous actors they used.
Yeah.
And he personally was like, you can't market this film on my name if you don't pay them.
I like, because he's first billed, which is crazy to me. Tom Selleck is second billed, which is just as crazy because he's in like 4 minutes of the film.
And so furry. So furry.
Oh my God.
And Tom Selleck is only in the film because he wanted to work with Marlon Brando. He admits his casting is stupid. He thinks the whole film is bad. And he apparently almost, when Marlon Brando was fighting, Tom Selleck, the reason they ended up paying Marlon Brando is Tom Selleck says, I'm walking off if I'm not working with Brando.
We'll talk about this a bit more, but most of the reviews of The Discovery are very negative. And the thing about doing these dueling Columbuses is it gave reviewers so many avenues for puns and for a film about discovering the world is round, it sure is flat. Like that's a lot of there's one Variety review, which Becky pointed out to me and I read multiple times because I can't believe
Wild.
It because it's so positive and it makes no sense. And so there's two reviews in this review of Brando and Tom Selleck. The first review of Brando, the reviewer says, and I'm not going to say what her name is. You'll find it by Googling. I'm not going to call her out. Brando makes a grand inquisitor. Great line.
That's
right. Then on Tom Selleck, she writes, Tom Selleck's wry turn as King Ferdinand is a pleasant surprise, although a wan Rachel Ward, who plays Queen Isabella, could use more backbone in her evangelical enthusiasm.
Okay.
Who wrote this review?
Like, no, my favorite, if I may, because I wrote down my favorite quotes. This is one of those things where I was like, Jesus. Okay, so she writes this like it's a good thing. Columbus's explanation of his navigating theory using a large melon as a globe is fun and effective. One almost expects him to burst into a Rodgers and Hammerstein-style song about his love of adventure.
Yeah, the other film uses an orange. Everyone always says, like, what fruit are they going to use in this film? There's another, can we go back to the review?
Of course, I've got another good one too.
Okay. This is actually how she ends the review. Script neglects to clarify that Cipango is an ancient term for Japan. She also notes that Benicio del Toro is the worst actor in this film.
Oh,
Benicio.
Poor young Benicio.
Soon to win Academy Award, Benicio del Toro.
My personal favorite is, overall, supporting players have interesting faces and okay delivery.
So does that mean indigenous people?
I'm presuming so.
I mean, yeah, or the other sailors, I guess.
I
will say it's worth noting for any of the actors who are burnt in this, almost every single actor is not the first choice other than Marlon Brando. Mm-hmm. The man who plays Christopher Columbus, George Coraface, I don't know how to pronounce it.
Coraface.
Sure.
He's French, isn't he?
He's Greek.
Is he? Great. Okay.
No. Well, then this just muddles my pronunciation. It was supposed to be Timothy Dalton is the important thing. Timothy Dalton was cast, and Isabella Rossellini was supposed to play the Queen. And when Timothy Dalton got to set, 3 days before filming began, he noticed that none of the famous actors who he had been told were cast. He checked with his bank. I guess normally you get a guarantee statement that you are going to be paid. That did not exist.
Didn't come true.
So he successfully, I believe, sued them for a $25 million breach of contract because they did not have the actors they had said that they would, and they could not guarantee to give him his $2.5 million fee. To be fair, this production, as we will probably note, essentially bankrupted. They also said Dustin Hoffman would be in it, who I don't think ever got told. Also, it was supposed to be directed by George Cosmatos, which he expected when he came on set. They tried to hire John Glenn, who had done the 80s James Bonds, to please Timothy Dalton. They also hired a bunch of James Bond actors, including Benicio del Toro and Robert Davi, to try to please him.
There's a lot of skullduggery on this. This is like the most skullduggery.
And I mean, I'm fascinated to know that's like that they so obviously were not going to pay him that Timothy Dalton could tell before the film even started and was like, peace. And if you guys also don't know, the super digging in, the whole crazy thing that really blew up the Salkinds is the fact that Alexander's the father, Ilya's the son. Ilya, his partner was Jane Chaplin, Charlie Chaplin's daughter. She had fronted $6 million to allow them to make the film. Then essentially all these crafty, grifty things were happening to the point where Ilya charged him with, beyond other things, contract fraud, breach of good faith and fair dealing, and racketeering.
Whoa!
He essentially, because he would not pay back Jane, so he essentially accused his own father of doing the producers.
Yeah. The sad
like
thing
he
about
producers
this film
did.
Is it broke up a father-son relationship.
Among all the other
and from
things.
What I can tell, from what I can tell, forever.
Oh.
Alexander Salkin says that Ilya Salkin says his mother will no longer, like in 1992, Ilya Salkin says his mother will no longer talk to him. Alexander Salkin says his son won't talk to him and he's not allowed to see his grandchildren.
I don't know what expression to have on my face because it's so horrible, but it's also like, oh my God, this movie did that.
It almost makes it worth it having to sit through this. Is that
cool? It's really crazy, and it's like it's a movie written by Mario Puzo with all this stuff.
Yeah,
like
we
say,
Mario Puzo
of the Godfather.
Yes, and of Superman. Yes. To be fair, a lot of people forget that Puzo did one of the drafts of Superman.
So just doing the math. So Timothy Dalton walks off 3 days before filming begins. That means the actor who played Columbus, George Coraface, or however we would like to pronounce it, had 24 hours to prepare.
I believe he was cast in another role, so he might have been familiar with the script.
So hopefully, he memorized these scripts other parts.
Yeah. And I think knowing all of this chaos with the actors, they all do a fairly good job.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone's doing a terrible. Tom Selleck is really maybe
no. Tom
maybe
Selleck
the worst.
Is terrible.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
I mean, he fully admits he took this as
his
a goof because he wanted to meet
Marlon Brando. Cloak has more personality than he does in this film. There's a lot of cloak swishing.
But he's not in it a ton. I think Benicio del Toro is kind of fun. Both of these films decide to take Columbus a bit off the hook from some of the atrocities against the indigenous people by casting. They decide to choose a couple guys who are the real, like, essentially Columbus turned a blind eye to these more violent men who did bad stuff. I think he's interesting. Catherine Zeta-Jones gets nothing to do, so she's
so young.
Beautiful.
Well, now just Sigourney Weaver in the other movie, right?
Yeah, we should probably switch to 1492.
Yes,
and
okay.
Try
I will
talk
say
about
thing I give this movie before we move to 1492 is it does admit to Columbus's ties to slavery, which I think the other movie dodges pretty hard. Yeah, once again, it also has a kind of interesting portrayal of the indigenous people. I think probably through the push of Marlon Brando, they bother to have a scene where an indigenous person, rather than being taken back to Spain to show the queen, chooses to essentially commit suicide. He tries to swim back to the island. And also they have the indigenous people rising up and murdering the crummy people they have left over, which is actually probably not what happened. Like, probably what happened is actually what they say in the other movie. But yeah. It's so there is at least you see the indigenous people be pushed too far by the bad guys. But it has a lot less of the atrocities, which are much more in the other movie, 1492, Conquest of Paradise.
A lot of atrocities in Conquest of Paradise.
Yeah. Well, Conquest of Paradise, I mean, it opens with witch burnings, right? So it's know what we're getting into.
I actually appreciate that. Like, it gave me a bit of hope for the film opening with very graphic scenes of the Spanish Inquisition and not having Marlon Brando as the grand inquisitor. It's you know right from the beginning, and I guess this is a theme with a lot of Ridley Scott's films to come, like Kingdom of Heaven and Gladiator, like it's going to be graphic, it's going to be dark, this isn't going to be as sugar-coated as like the VHS that your, you know, grade 7 history teacher put on explaining Columbus.
Yes. This is, you're right. This is not a thing you would show in school.
No.
The Inquisition? No.
Well, yes. I watched Name of the Rose high school. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Ridley Scott, I mean, is called Conquest of Paradise.
Yeah.
He is interested in the tragedy of Columbus. The fact that this guy maybe had a positive, high-minded idea and it just went so badly. Because, like, I mean, it's undeniable that Columbus was arrested and brought back to Spain for how poorly things went. I think both films really overlook the devastating effect of smallpox, the fact that the Arawak were essentially genocided within the decade, which was mostly smallpox, but also a lot of them murdering them and enslaving them to dig for gold.
I will say the discovery, it's very brief, but you see the rat. It's so subtle, but the rat runs from the ship down a rope into the water. And so it's kind of like for the viewer to assume that will be what causes so much of smallpox and the plague.
If you know about that at all, you know.
Yes, if you know about that.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's just a cute rat doing something silly.
Can I just quickly derail for a second? My family and I have this whole thing where we were watching a movie once where a rat runs across an alley in an establishing shot. And it just occurred to us all at the same time that someone had to cue that rat. So in our family, we then became, before something began, we'd go, "And cue the rat." And so that's just one of our family things. I just
Your family sounds fun. My family watches Hand the Rock to the Cradle.
I mean, the other interesting thing I think with this film is it's written by a woman, Rosalind Bosch, who's a journalist, and was essentially she was doing research for a Parisian magazine, Le Point, and she looked into the letters of Columbus. And
she went to the archive and like lived there.
Yeah, for a long time.
It's crazy. Years.
It's interesting for how intense the research was. But almost immediately she thought it was a screenplay, which is interesting. She's like, this is a screenplay. And she is very obsessed with essentially the truth. Because I guess, you know, she was doing it for so long and so early that she probably saw this uprising of protest from indigenous peoples. And I think she became interested because she's like, there's kind of these two cliches where it's like he's this pure genocide guy and he's this pure hero. And she says that it's kind of in between because she so much of the violence and slavery and things, she's like, that was a part of the world. So it's hard to know his intentions. So that's what fascinated her in the story. And I think what fascinated Ridley Scott as well, because I think both of them say there is no question that what happened is an awful tragedy. But how much was this man involved? How much was he affected? I think we know he's a little more involved than they show in the story. They do also make a pretty classic mustache twirling villain out of a guy who we know was kind of involved, but we don't know if he was the sole let's cut people's hand off guy. Because even as the historian points out, people's hands were being cut off in Spain at the time. So it probably wouldn't have fazed Columbus to say cut their hands off.
Yeah, this is just how we treat people. Yeah.
Yeah.
That scene is horrifying.
I mean, the whole thing is really, it's a rough watch. Like, even watching them all succumb to scurvy and serious isolation issues on the boat, that's a tough watch. Like, it's like, yeah, this was no picnic for anybody.
There's a few positives. I'm trying in my life and on this podcast at the same time to be more positive and kind. One avenue is going better than the other. I really like the Vangelis score.
Yes.
Of course, it's not really Scott's first time working with Vangelis, who did the soundtrack for Blade Runner, like so iconic. And actually doing some research on Vangelis and like what are kind of considered his best, what's the best work. This rates very high up there with music critics. Mm-hmm. Not as a film, just as the tracks. And I did listen to it isolated. It is beautiful. Like, it's choral music that Vangelis used a certain form of Latin to communicate. It's quite elaborate. And I do think the cinematography, and just so we're clear, it's Costa Rica that they choose to have be the new world. It's
beautiful.
Like the images of the ships. If you are a ship enthusiast like Ridley Scott, I can't think of a better film for you, because I was actually quite enraptured with just looking at the ships. The ones from the Discovery look like a Disney theme park ride. Like, it's ridiculous how bad they look.
Yeah.
These are the actual ships that Cam alluded to earlier in the episode that were built for the reconstruction.
I think that these are actually another set of ships. I tried to look it up.
Good Lord.
It's crazy that the two sets, because these ones I think were built in Britain.
Built at the same time?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But you're right. You're right that Ridley Scott had the exact same intention. But I just think he maybe had no access to those boats.
The other thing that I would say for this film is, my God, some of the supporting actors. Like, you have Benicio del Toro in The Discovery, and he's not quite yet the Benicio that we know. And I don't think he's as bad as the woman in Variety thinks he is. But the character actors in 1492, Armand Assante, Checky Cairo, Michael Wincott, who is the main villain, who looks like a universal monster from the 1930s. He is terrifying and effective, and I think this is one of his best roles.
Yeah.
There are some things to praise for 1492.
Yeah.
Depardieu, for me, as Columbus, is a bit ridiculous.
Agreed.
I found him ridiculous.
He was, it's worth saying, he was coming in super hot. He had the relatively unheard of at the time best actor nomination for Cyrano de Bergerac. So he was, and it was really him trying to kickstart that brief 1 second of, like, my father the hero green card American career that he tried, which is kind of crazy, because this is also like, we know how much further he would go to seed, but this is a bit of a gone to seed Gerard Depardieu. He's not the sexy hot guy from the French films.
No, he's gone full Columbus.
Yes.
This is something I always have issues with too, is watching movies that don't just commit to an accent or a nationality.
I
think that it's like, okay, so you do have people with Spanish accents, French, English, American, like, it's, but they're all intended to be Spanish. That's always a little like,
ugh. Very few Spanish or Hispanic people are involved, I will say, is an odd thing.
I feel like a film like this, if they're going for that kind of authenticity, and you have someone using their archival research, and you're building these ships, like, you are going the full yard. I don't know what that metaphor is. Never mind.
Yeah. Whole nine yards. It's a thing.
Stop using. Another goal in my life on this podcast and life is to understand my mixed metaphors. But
I love them.
Why wouldn't you just go subtitles? Even in 92, there were multiple films that were entirely subtitled, especially if you want a Best Picture nom. Subtitling is completely reasonable. And I felt like that would have been okay, except you do have some English-speaking actors that probably couldn't do Spanish.
Yeah, lots of American actors. Worth also saying, for this one, they also used a lot of indigenous people, 170 actors from four different tribes in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
Also, they brought back the six main actors from The Mission, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, one is Bercilio Moya, who's probably the most recognizable. He's one of the young indigenous boys in The Mission, and he's one of the only credited named characters that's indigenous. He's Utapan, who kind of becomes like the most important translator and kind of orchestrator for the indigenous peoples. And his performance, he only has two credits, The Mission in 1986, so he was very young, and this, and he's really good.
He has the equivalent of that guy throwing himself over the boat in The Discovery. He has the best burn, where Columbus is like, oh, Utapan, why have you forsaken me? And he's like, you never bothered to learn my language, and just like fails.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, you rule, dude.
I would say this is a 2.5-hour film.
Yes.
If you can somehow get through the first hour and a half, which is entirely the voyage, and get to that second, mostly third act, where they're in San Salvador. It is quite impressive. Even watching them raise the bell, so they build this. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, just the concept, they had to build that bell too.
Oh, totally,
for a
yeah.
prop.
And the city.
And they're trying, like, yeah. yeah, and the city. And they have to raise it up into a church. And just the risk and the danger and, like,
that they brought that instead of food is what makes me go, what
yeah.
are you doing?
Oh, yeah. I think the fact,
yeah,
I also,
bring a bag of limes yeah. so you don't get scurvy.
They didn't know that. but you're too cutting edge. But yeah,
sorry.
I think you're right, Alicia, that what makes this more interesting is that it is not about the first sailing.
Yeah.
It is about half about the first sailing and half
it's
about
the
multiple
sailing.
Returns and especially yeah. the revolution, people rising up against Columbus and yeah. then essentially like, yeah, his ruination in court. He was forgiven by the queen, but he essentially became an exile
Exiled.
For the end of his
yeah.
life. And a lot of the reason why we have these warring visions of Columbus. I mean, the hero is gone. That's just not true. Let's say that for sure. But a lot of the reason why we don't know what he was responsible for is because there was such a harsh propaganda campaign against him. There was a very yeah. big anti-Italian sentiment in Spain following it. So it's hard to tell what he was specifically responsible for. Like, did he release the dogs on people? Did he say indigenous babies make great dog food? Hard to know.
Oh my God.
He might have. And he definitely was like a huge part in the genocide. But yeah, it's interesting. And I also agree that I am not this kind of guy, but I know that there are plenty of men in the world who are like Ridley Scott, who love to watch sailing stuff and the reality of sailing stuff. And this gets into incredibly crunchy, like, how the rigging works.
Uh-huh.
It gets yeah. very into, because he's very interested. I think Ridley Scott kind of hates religion. He's fascinated by it, but hates it. So he gets deeply into the fact that Columbus knew what he was doing because he listened to Muslim scholars and Muslim
yeah.
navigation rather mm-hmm. than Christian navigation, which was just hoodoo.
The Moroccan, yeah, yeah. like the Moors, the Moorish
yes.
way of following stars.
So
which
yeah,
is really
he has like a sextant, which is like mm-hmm. forbidden probably in
Heresy.
Spain.
Heresy, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, it's very interesting to say that not that like there's none of these are about the earth is flat, the earth is round kind of thing. They're more about the fact that the Christianity had pushed science down so hard
yeah.
that it was heresy to believe science, which was mostly Asian and Muslim and African.
What a timely thought. I do. There's a line, there's a sentence that Jeff Bourdieu utters as Columbus that I actually wrote down because I was like, oh, that's at the heart of what we're talking about. And it's paradise and hell can both be earthly.
Mm.
And I was just like, ooh. Yeah. I got shivers a little bit. I was like,
yeah.
Well, we've been talking about depictions of Columbus, and I would like to point us towards the third film that was released this year, because I am fascinated by this,
yes.
and I am so excited for us to do Titanic, because, guys, I've got some stuff
oh,
there.
God. I'm familiar with Titanic 2 or whatever.
Oh, no, my friend, just wait.
They are doing Titanic, so get ready.
I thought so. Here we go. There is an animated feature for children called The Magic Voyage from 1992. Mm. It is of German origin. And just to give you a little bit of perspective on where this is coming from, the director, Michael Schumann, said that he wanted to create a film from a more satirical view in order to differentiate ourselves clearly from the lofty views of history, so we can present Columbus as a lovable, charming, and befuddled scholar rather than having him portrayed as a greedy explorer as depicted in history books.
Yeah.
Befuddled.
Befuddled scholar.
Well, Alicia, you will be pleased that he is voiced by voice of Munchie Dom DeLuise.
That's
in
right.
The American dub.
In the second dub, there's two English
yes,
dubs of this. The
two
first
English
one
dubs.
Has actors who are unfortunately not names. The second one is Corey Feldman and Irene Cara and Dom DeLuise and Samantha Egger. It's narrated by Mickey Rooney. So, you know, they brought up the big guns.
Samantha Egger.
Yes.
That?
She
I mean,
plays Isabella.
They're playing the classic characters you remember from these other two films, the Irene Cara is the queen of the fairies, and Corey Feldman is, of course, the talking woodworm.
Yeah, yeah. That's who's also known as a bookworm, and there's a bunch of debate on whether he's a bookworm or a woodworm. That's what people
yes.
really focused on for this movie.
This escaped my childhood.
And the woodworm,
I
did you
did
read that the
this.
Woodworm was originally, like, it was supposed to be a sequel to a movie about a woodworm on Noah's Ark.
Yep.
And then they decided to spin it off into its own thing.
Jesus. It's wild.
It's
Cam.
Yeah.
Cam sent me a fourth trailer
oh,
that
yes.
I regretted watching.
It is worth saying we can hem and haw over the discovery and whether it's worthwhile, but the Magic Voyage, I mean, it's for kids. I guess you can write it off. But the one you cannot write off is Carry On Columbus.
Oh, yeah.
The incredibly belated attempt to reboot the British sex comedy Carry On films, which, if you're not familiar, is basically about showing busty women doing things.
And it's full of double intenders. That's like the whole thing.
Yeah. And it had some interesting comedians of the time, but it is famously considered by most Carry On fans, as niche as that is, is one of the worst, if not the worst, Carry On film. Many of the actors say they wish it never happened, and it was once voted in a poll the worst British film of all time. I did not watch it, but that's a kind of fascinating. And actually, the funny thing is, as much as badly reviewed as it was, as poorly considered as it was, it still made more money than either The Discovery or 1492 in England.
Oh my God. Well, that tells you what they think about their colonialism.
I can't believe that. Yeah. I cannot believe that.
Oh my God.
Something that came to mind is if all the benefits of 1492 that I'm talking about, I would say watch 1987's Cobra Verde, which is a Werner Herzog film starring Klaus Kinski about the slave trade and around the same, I think it's more like 1600s. I could be wrong, but it's done better.
Yes.
It's just better.
I do.
Like, if you like that stuff I was talking about, just watch
Absolutely.
Cobra Verde.
I think that and Aguirre both heavily influenced Ridley Scott. And you see it. But I think that both of those are more, partially because it's Klaus Kinski being insane. But also might be worth saying that Werner Herzog might not have the best record of not abusing indigenous people.
He doesn't at all. But
Well, we can make a 1492 of Werner in 500 years, I guess.
Okay, I think we need to. That's where we need to end the episode. It's very
important.
Are you
sure? We could go on another hour.
Yeah. Easily.
There could be a fifth Columbus movie. Total failure of a film.
So amazing. All right. Okay. I think that's everything. I had so much fun with this one, guys. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Alicia Fletcher.
Thank you. I'm very ashamed of myself for some reason. I don't know why.
You were a delight to the senses, as always. Cameron Maitland, thank you so much.
I don't even know what to say at this point. Support Indigenous rights.
Yes, please.
Don't hope this is our best episode of the podcast.
I think we had a lot of fun in this one. The rough thing was when we were doing like the talk where we were going to talk about, withholding facts from each other, I think was the funnest part. Like, we did it on purpose.
Yeah, I know. I like that.
Okay, so that's all for this week. You can join us again in 2 weeks. Things are much lighter in 2007, guys. And we're going to have a look at a movie that featured Idina Menzel in a role where she was cast not to sing and Patrick Dempsey in a role where he was. That's coming up in 2 weeks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to chat with us and find more great content? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. The home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. Uncut and commercial-free on 4 HD channels and on demand. Learn how you can subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Kevin Lipset. Until next time.
I adore children, Mrs. Fartell.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.